In October of 1876, the people of France gave to the people of the United States a monument in recognition of the friendship that developed between those two nations during the American Revolution. That monument was, and is, the Statue of Liberty. It's also known as Liberty Enlightening the World, but we know it better as the Statue of Liberty. See if I can get a picture of it. Oh, wait, that's not the right one. That's... got to watch out for that George Lucas. He's everywhere. This coming October will mark the 128th anniversary of the giving of this gift from France to the United States. And originally, it was intended to be a centennial gift. October is not the centennial date. But the reason for that was that the agreement between the two nations was that France would make the statue, United States had to provide the site, and they had to build the base for it. So that France wanted the United States to commit to their part of it, our part of it, if you will, before they went forward on it. And so there were fundraising efforts, there was time involved in finding the site, and then by the time all of that was taken care of, October rolled around. Also, there was the matter that in France it was constructed, and then it was taken apart, and then it was shipped here to the States, and it had to be reassembled on the site. So there were reasons for those delays. Nonetheless, that symbol of friendship has grown into now a symbol of freedom and democracy. The fellow that was commissioned to create the sculpture is a fellow named Frederick Auguste Bartholdi. Bartholdi was known as a sculptor, but in stone primarily. He's fairly famous for a number of his pieces, things on a grand scale, large sculptures. And when Bartholdi began to work on this, he needed some assistance because he was working in a fairly new medium for him, which was copper sheets. Copper is not going to be strong enough to stand on its own unless it's really thick. That's not what they wanted. And Bartholdi was not a structural engineer, so he required the assistance of an engineer to address the structural issues, the underpinning, if you will, of what is inside Statue of Liberty. And so the committee in France that also selected Bartholdi chose a man to help them with this project. His name was Alexandre Eiffel. He was commissioned to do the main structural support inside the secondary skeletal framework because copper, like any kind of metal, is going to expand and contract. And so these copper panels are not really fixed as tight as you might think. They have to float a little bit. And so he needed the help of a structural engineer. Those of you who don't recognize the name Eiffel would probably recognize this monument, the Eiffel Tower. It's named after Mr. Eiffel. The dimensions of the, you probably can't read that very well, I apologize for the low resolution of that one, but the dimensions are very interesting. Statue of Liberty as it sits today is 151 feet, 1 inch high. The top of the torch, the very top of Liberty's torch there, is 305 feet, 1 inch from the low water mark in the surrounding harbor. When it was established, when it was put on that pedestal, it was the largest work of its kind that had ever been completed up to that time, and it was the tallest structure in New York City. Now remember, this is 1876. It was the tallest structure in New York City until the Empire State Building was built in 1929. What's even more impressive for me, for the sake of this message today, is the detail on the back of Liberty's head. Most people don't get a chance to see it. Where Liberty is positioned in New York Harbor, there's not a lot around it, and certainly not anything that tall. And Bartholdi gave as much attention to the back of Liberty's head as he did for the rest of the statue. And if you can find a picture of the back of the head, which I found very difficult to do, you would see that he sculpted the hair detail on her head with as much concern, if you will, as he did the rest of the sculpture. There's a more direct view of the back. Maybe you can see some of that detail. Why did he do this? Why did he spend so much time on a part of the sculpture that most people, at least for a long, long time, would never even notice or even see? He had no idea that other structures would eventually be taller than Liberty. He probably never envisioned something like a helicopter. Now you can take helicopter flights right around Liberty. But he cared very much about his reputation. This is how he earned his living. And so it was important to him, even if no one else was going to see the top of Liberty's head, it was important to him to do the best work he could. Also, as I mentioned, this was built in France originally, and he built it in pieces. And there you can see Liberty's head sitting on a smaller pedestal as they put this together. People would notice the work that was there, even if later they would not. Bear in mind as well, as I've mentioned, he worked in copper. And if you're going to emboss or deboss, depending on your process, in copper, you're going to see it on both sides. And so even to this day, that's another view of the back of the head, even to this day, most people can no longer go up in Liberty. Years ago, you could. At the top of the crown, these are the windows at the front of her crown. So this is the top of her head on the outside. So even if you never saw it from the outside, from the inside, you're still going to see the detail of the work that he did. The question becomes then, for the sake of the sermon today, how good a job do we do when no one is looking? Or if when we think no one will see the entire project? Well, the purpose of today is to continue the sermon series I started a few weeks back on the five aspects of character that was the theme of this year's United Youth Camps. Today's sermon will cover the second part of godly character, and that is integrity and doing what is right. Integrity and doing what is right. We need to begin then by defining what integrity is. And the dictionary definition is an adherence to moral and ethical principles, soundness of moral character, and honesty. A synonym to integrity is virtue. If you ever want to do an interesting Bible study, go home, pull out your concordance or your computer program, and go through virtue in Scripture and how often it's talked about. This is what it's talking about, integrity. In order to become godly leaders, having godly character is imperative. It's not an option, it's imperative. As a result of that godly character, then, those individuals are leaders and servants. People who serve and lead by example. Because character is a mind quality. It's not a physical attribute. It's a process of thinking and developing a certain outlook and behavior based on certain characteristics. So how do we know if someone is a person of character or not? The simple answer, as my dad reminded me of when I was younger, that someone of character is a person who does the right thing when no one is looking. Because it doesn't matter if anyone sees you. You're going to do the right thing. We must first learn, as we covered last time, we must first learn what is right. That's the knowledge aspect. You and I have to know God's expectations and His law and His holy days and observances, how to worship Him and so forth. That knowledge is the foundation, but it's not the end. There are a lot of people that understand aspects of God's truth in Scripture, whether it's the Sabbath days, holy days, and so forth, but they don't all follow them. So the second aspect is, as up there on the screen, we must then learn to do what is right. This is the application of knowledge. And that brings us to our sub-theme of character in today's sermon, that is integrity. Because what we're talking about, as we've touched on already, is that we're considering the responsibility of always doing what is spiritually right, no matter what. That's our calling. It's not a matter of convenience. It's not a matter of outward approval or any of these other things. It's a matter of doing what God expects, no matter what. And that brings us to the lesson. We're going to use the story of Ruth. The integrity of Ruth is a great theme, or a great complement to the theme of what we're covering today. Ruth was an outstanding example of the integrity that we're talking about. And the book of Ruth is very interesting because God includes a story of a woman in Scripture, a whole book dedicated to her story. Along with that, a woman who was not an Israelite. And along with that, he does not use the book in terms of prophecy or in terms of teaching direct doctrine. It is simply a story especially in light of what we're covering today, of how someone lives God's way of life. So we're going to use that as a framework for the rest of the message here today. To set the stage a little bit, Ruth lived during the time of the judges. This is the time before Israel had kings, before they had a structured government. God didn't intend for them to go that direction. He wanted them to trust on Him, for Him to be their king, for them to follow His instruction, and He would have blessed them, and at times He did. As they yielded to that, they were blessed, but then oftentimes, as was the case during this time period especially, they would drift spiritually, morally, socially, until they got to a point where it was so bad, God would send another nation usually to correct them, and they would go through a period of punishment, they would repent, and the process would start all over again. So Ruth is during this time of decline, if you will. We'll see some of that as we get into the book. And it's very similar to the time we're in now in many ways. We look at the culture around us, and it's definitely in a time of decline, spiritually, morally. Yet God continues to work in the lives of His faithful elect. As He did then, He's doing now. Ruth, as a young married woman, faced trials in her life, as all of us do. Let's pick up the story in the beginning of Ruth, chapter 1. The family faced a lot of sad history, a lot of trials, seemingly early on, if you will. There was a famine in the land, as we read in the beginning of the book, and the family of Elimelech leaves Israel and goes to Moab. Now, there's a lot of reasons why that was a bad decision. We don't have time to cover all of them today, but Elimelech was to be a leader in the nation. He was of the tribe of Judah, and he was of the birthright line within Judah. As such, he had a responsibility, if you will, to stay in Israel, to be an example of trusting in God and waiting on Him. Instead of doing that, he left. He left the nation. And in doing so, he set in a series of other choices that his family ended up making that were not good choices. Ruth 1, verse 3, we'll pick it up. It says, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. So after they had been in the land in some time, the husband dies. Elimelech dies. This puts a severe strain on the family, changes the whole dynamics of things now. And so then it says Naomi was left with her two sons. Rather than reassessing their life, they stayed in Moab, which is not what God wanted them to do. And so in verse 4, they took wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah, the other was named Ruth, and they dwelt there for about 10 years. So they sort of regroup. Things seem to be going okay, but then verse 5, both Mahlon and Chilion died. So the woman survived, her two sons and her husband, meaning Naomi. Now, if you want to do some extra Bible study at some point, go home and look up what Mahlon and Chilion, what those names mean. They had been facing trials for a fairly long time, it might seem, based on these names alone, because they're not happy names. They're very sad names when you look up the meaning of them. But now Naomi and the two daughters-in-law are left without any security. They're left without anyone to protect them, provide for them, for their safety, or any of those things that we might take for granted. And so then it sets in motion a number of things in their life. And so then in chapter 1, verse 8, we come to the part of the story where it says, Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go return each to her mother's house. Why the mother's house? Why not the father's? Naomi's telling them, I can't take care of you. I don't have any other sons that you can marry. But why the mother's house? Well, oftentimes there would be multiple wives for one man. So rather than go back to a general household, so specifically back to your mother's household is what she's telling her. And it says they went on their way to return to the land of Judah. She was intending to go back now at this point. Back home. So verse 8, she says to her two daughters-in-law, go back to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me, and the Lord grant that you may find rest. This is not just rest as in I'm physically tired. This means rest as in security, that you will find a husband, someone to take care of you and provide for you, each in the house of her husband. So she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. It's a very sad time because they realize that they may never see her again. This family now is breaking up. And so what to do? Ruth, we find, did not want to do this. She wanted to stay with her mother-in-law, Naomi. We're not told the exact reasons why, but we could guess a lot of things. She probably had a very good relationship with her, a friendship. There was a lot of familiarity there. Maybe she didn't have a good family life where she came from. We're not told that. But maybe it was simply that she saw Naomi's God as somebody that she wanted to have a relationship with. Because remember, Ruth was from Moab. They didn't worship the God of the Old Testament, the God of the Bible. They didn't have the framework of the Ten Commandments and the structure of those moral aspects that God puts in His law. They didn't have a lot of the protection God puts in His instruction. Maybe she saw that and wanted to be a part of it. No matter what it was, she didn't want to leave. And so then we go to verse 16 of chapter 1. And so here then we find that they end up leaving. Orpah returned, verse 14, Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And so then verse 16, Ruth says this to Naomi. And notice what she says here. Treat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you, for wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, your God, my God. Verse 17, where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. The Lord do to me so and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. There's integrity. There's a lot of integrity in there. Because she was not willing. Did Naomi have any clue? I mean, Ruth. Did Ruth have any clue as to what she was going to do to help Naomi survive in life? I don't know. What skills would a woman of this time period have had? Very limited in terms of providing for a family. But she threw her lot in, if you will. She says, I have committed myself to making sure that you're taken care of. Remember the definition of integrity, adherence to moral or ethical principles. In Ruth's mind, she had made a commitment to the family, and she was not going to walk away from that. So it's very interesting what she's committing to here. She must have had a deep respect for Naomi and a desire to continue with her. I won't go so far as to say that Ruth had a loving relation or loving friendship with Naomi, but I would think that that's not too far off the mark. I think we see that manifested in much of what Ruth expresses in the whole book, her desire to take care of her mother-in-law, and she knew that that meant a sacrifice. Hold your place here in Ruth. We'll be back because we're going to use this as the framework of the sermon, but let's go to Ezekiel 22. Ezekiel 22 is one of these verses that I find myself coming back to on a regular basis. Because it speaks to this matter of integrity. It speaks to the matter of the commitment that each one of us that are baptized especially has made to be a part of God's family now. Ezekiel 22 and verse 30, God here speaking through the prophet Ezekiel says, so I sought for a man among them who would make a wall and stand in the gap before me on behalf of the land that I should not destroy it, but I found none. God's looking for men and women of integrity. During Ezekiel's time, he wasn't able to find much of that. Will he find much of it in this end time? Christ phrased it another way. He asked the question, will the Son of Man find faith? I think they're the same thing in the context. Ruth knew that this commitment that she made was going to be difficult. I don't think she was under any delusions that it would be a simple life. First of all, she's going to a foreign land. Whether she had God as her God in her mind at this point or not, she also realized that it would change the cultural context of what she did, how she did things. And it would probably impact other things as well, going back as a widow, not having the security of a husband, a family in that regard. But Ruth showed remarkable character and devotion. I think especially in light of coming out of a pagan society. Some of you understand that, having come out of other religions, but to kind of walk away from everything you've known. Abraham did the same thing when God called him, right? He said, leave this land, go to the land that I'll give to you. But he was leaving everything he knew. Ruth is doing the same thing here. She had heard of Israel's God. She had perhaps seen him through Naomi's family, and she wanted to be as much a part of that way of life as she could be. She wanted what that represented. She desired to have that relationship with the one true God, a covenant relationship with him. She was going to commit to that. That meant putting certain things into action, like making the sacrifice of going back to Judah with Naomi. At the end of chapter 1 in the book of Ruth, Naomi and Ruth, we find, have returned to Israel, specifically to Bethlehem, which was Naomi's hometown, at the very beginning of the barley harvest. This would have been roughly around the time of Passover, in the days of unleavened bread. In Ruth 2, then, we're introduced to another character in the story, if you will, a relative of Naomi's husband, as it says there, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. Now, different Bible scholars differ on the interpretation of who Boaz was in terms of the family structure. My personal opinion is that he was the youngest of the three brothers. There was Elimelech, and then there's the middle brother, who's, we'll come to later, is never named. And then there's Boaz. And so Boaz is introduced here. We find that Boaz is a man of great wealth, which is very ironic. Elimelech left under very difficult times, and yet his brother Boaz, as he stayed in the land, prospered. I have to wonder what Naomi thought of that. He had wealth because he had workers as well, we know. He had so much land that it required this extra help. He was well respected in the community. We'll see that later. And his family was of the birthright line of the tribe of Judah. We find next in chapter 2, verse 2, that Ruth asks Naomi for permission to go work. It's very interesting that she would submit to Naomi's authority, if you will, still within the family. She still viewed her as the one to go to in terms of authority within the family. And she asks permission to go glean in the fields. This was not an easy job. This is all done by hand. The main workers would go through with sickles or scythes, and they would cut the stalks. And then you'd have another group of men, usually, sometimes women, come behind them, gather these stalks up into various sized sheets, kind of tie them together and stack them in bundles. And so she was going to go, as was provided back in Leviticus 19, she was going to go work the field. The poor were allowed to do that. God said to those that owned land, when you harvest, you can't pick up every grain that drops. If it drops in the ground, you're to leave it. And you're not to harvest the corners. So the poor were provided for, but they were not given everything. The farmer wasn't required to harvest it and put it in bags and hand it to them. They had to go out and work, and it was hard work, bent over in the heat of the day, cutting in some cases, and picking up. If you've ever looked at heads of wheat or heads of barley, and you can imagine all of that scattered on the ground, and you have to collect it. This is the job that Ruth is doing here. It was a lot of hard work. And so in chapter 2, verse 3, we pick up the story here that Boaz recognizes Ruth. He pays attention to her. Verse 3, then she left. Naomi had given permission to go do this, and so Ruth left. She went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come, and I don't think that was happen chance. I think God was directing it even at this point. She happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. And it says, now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered, the Lord bless you as well. So he had a good relationship with his workers. Verse 5, Boaz says to his servant who is in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? Who is this lady? I don't know her. I don't recognize her. Whose family is she a part of? So the servant, verse 6, who was in charge of the reapers, answered and said, is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. And she said, please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. And so she came and continued, notice, from morning till now. We'll see in a later verse that it said, until evening, until everybody else quit and went home. She was there through the whole day, bearing the heat of everything. And notice, it says she remains until now, though she rested a little in the house. Now, the house is not a house as we would understand it. It would be basically an awning that would be put up out in the field, like a canopy, so that workers could come in, get something to drink, and get out of the heat of the sun for a time. So he said, unless she needed a break, she's been out there all day. So you can imagine how impressed Boaz would be with this. And so in verse 8, he says to Ruth, "Will you listen to me, my daughter? Will you not? Do not go and glean in another field, nor go from here, but stay close by my young women." There would, as I mentioned, be some of the women that would come behind picking up these cut stalks of barley and, in other cases, wheat. And so he says, "Stay with my women." Verse 9, "Let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. Have I not commanded the young men not to touch you?" See, Ruth is already falling under the protection of Boaz here. As Boaz is intrigued by her, he sees her hard work, he sees her dedication to Naomi, and he's impressed with her integrity. One of the things that Naomi recognized was their vulnerability. And this is what Boaz is touching on here. He's basically telling her, "I can make sure that you will be safe here if you stay in my field." He says, "When you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn." So she fell on her face, bowed down to the ground, and said, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice from me, a foreigner?" Now, notice Ruth's humble attitude here. She could have said, "Well, it's mine to come do. God provided for it, Leviticus. You know, your field's as good as the next." You know, she wasn't snarky about it all. She was very respectful here. And this integrity shows even in the way she interacts with Boaz. And so she's true to her word again. She told Naomi that she would go do this. She followed God's instruction, even if she may not have understood all of it. We don't know to what degree she did or didn't. But she was even ethical and honest towards Boaz. Not demanding more, not expecting others to do for her. And so then in verse 11, it says, "Boaz answered and said to her, 'It has been fully reported to me.'" Notice, it's not just what he has observed. It's not just that she's another pretty face that intrigues her. He says, "I've listened to what other people have said. All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you left your father and mother in the land of your birth, and you've come to a people whom you did not know before. May the Lord repay your work, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." Then she said, "Let me find favor in your eyes, your sight, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I am not like one of your maidservants." See, she knew she was a foreigner. She was still very deferential here to Boaz. And so he begins to show her favor as well. He was going out of his way, if you will, to make sure she was taken care of, that she was protected, and that she would be able to help Naomi even in this way. Chapter 2, verse 17, then, to move down a little bit, said, "So when she gleaned in the field till evening," this is what I was referring to earlier, "the worker said she's been here since morning. Now it says she stayed until evening, beating out what she had gleaned." As I mentioned, in the corners, these would have been full stalks. She would have had to have cut those, and then she would have had to have beaten the heads of grain off the tops. So she's doing this at the end of the day, and what she gathered, it says, was about an ephah of barley. Now, that probably doesn't mean anything to us. We don't know what an ephah is. We don't use that measurement. It's a dry measurement, and it's about 65% of a modern, what we call a bushel basket. That probably doesn't mean much to us either, since most of us are not farmers. All right, so we'll put it in a context of something we might understand. It's about 8 gallons. If you took dry barley heads and put them in 8-gallon jars, that's about how much she would have gathered. Now, that may or may not sound like a lot to you, but if you're picking up individual grains and you're having to cut and beat out these heads in some cases, that's a fair amount of grain. We'll see here in a moment that Naomi's impressed here. In terms of weight, it would be about 31 pounds of grain. As I mentioned, she would have had to have done hard work, not only the picking up, but the cutting. She would have been bent over most of the day. She would have been in the heat most of the day. It was a lot of hard work. character, developing integrity of what we're talking about today, only comes from hard and consistent work. That's probably why we don't see a lot of it today. This work then, this hard and consistent work, becomes our reputation. This is what Boaz saw in Ruth. She worked hard. Not just a little bit. Because this harvest season would go for weeks. Because remember, they're doing this all by hand. They don't have big John Deere combines to drive through the fields, you know, that are just cutting thousands and thousands of bushels at a time. They're doing this all by hand. They're threshing it by hand. They're having to put it in bags, and they're having to carry it, put it on carts, and take it to wherever they're going to store it or sell it. It's a lot of hard work. Boaz sees this as well. And the bottom line for us to consider in many ways as well is what the example of Ruth is indicating, is that no one else is responsible for our reputation. See, she could have given up at any time. She could have used the excuse, I'm not an Israelite, or she could have said any number of things, but she was determined to do the right thing, no matter what. When I gave this sermon this morning in Oshkosh, I mentioned my grandfather, my dad's dad, and he did a number of different type of jobs over his lifetime, careers. One thing he did off and on through most of his life was wallpapering. And I may have inherited a number of things from him, but I did not inherit his patience for wallpapering. But that was done a lot back then because they didn't have plasterboard. A lot of that was done by hand, so wallpapering was an easy way to smooth out on a wall and to make it presentable. Oftentimes what he would do, though, before he would paper the walls, he would sign his name. He would sign his name on the wall in pencil, and then he would paper the wall. Why would he do that? Well, for the same reason Bartholdi did what he did with the head of the Statue of Liberty. It was important for him to know that he would put his name to it, even if nobody would ever know. Because the thing is that from time to time, somebody would know. They would remodel a house that my grandfather had papered, and they'd pull the paper off, and they'd see there on the wall in big letters, Charlie Dowd. And it would intrigue them, and they'd pull out the phone book, and in the town I lived in, there were about five Dowds listed in the phone book, and so they would begin calling them and say, are you related to Charlie Dowd? He put his name out there because he did the work that he thought he needed to do. Chapter 2, verse 19. Naomi then sees all the work that Ruth has done, and she says to Ruth, where have you gleaned today? 8 gallons of barley. She's impressed. She says, where did you work? Blessed be the one who took notice of you. Now, this is not disparaging Ruth. She's not saying, you couldn't have done all of this. She recognized that someone gave her help, though. And she says, who was this? And so Ruth told her mother-in-law, whom she had worked with, and said, the man's name with whom I work today is Boaz. Then Naomi makes the connection. Ruth was oblivious to this. But Naomi makes the connection, and she says, blessed be the Eternal who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead. And Naomi said to her, this man is a relation of ours, one of our close relatives. And I believe it's the King James wording that says he's a near kinsman. We'll come back to that thought in a moment. That's an important phrase here. But then Ruth goes on to explain to Naomi what Boaz did in offering protection, telling her to stay in the field, and that she would be watched over. And Ruth understood what this meant. One of the aspects of God's instruction is not just our obedience, but also what we do for others in that obedience. Boaz certainly did this, but Naomi recognizes what he's doing as well here. One of the things that God cares very deeply about is those that are vulnerable, if you will, that they're not taken advantage of. In the book of James, it talks about pure religion being undefiled as this, that we take care of the widows and the orphans, which means we help provide for them. We make sure that they're taken care of. Boaz did this before it was ever recorded by James. He was making sure the widows were taken care of. Because he did that, then God blessed him. Because Ruth did what she did, she was blessed. You see how this is not a zero-sum game, that God will reward, if you will, the effort when we do the right thing. But notice what Naomi sets in motion next. Chapter 3 and verse 1. Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, that is Ruth, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you?" What she's saying here is, before I die, I need to know that you're taken care of, that you have a husband, that you will have security in life. Because family was all they had at that time. They didn't have Social Security. They didn't have Medicare. They didn't have other social programs to fall back on. If the family didn't take care of them, they had nothing, really. They were truly vulnerable. Boaz recognized that. That's why he offered the protection he did. Naomi recognizes that, and she says, "This is on my mind. I want to make sure that you're taken care of." So she sets this in motion. Verse 2, "Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not our relative?" Why is that important? We'll come back to that in a moment. "In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight on the threshing floor." They had harvested everything. They had these bundles of barley stalks, and now they need to thresh the heads out, and they're going to collect all of that. So she says, verse 3, "Wash yourself, anoint yourself, put on your best garment, and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known until the man has finished eating and drinking." Now, oftentimes what would happen after one of these big harvests is there'd be a celebration. A lot of hard work. It could be a couple of months worth of work, depending on the harvest and depending on the size of the fields and everything involved. And Boaz shows himself to be a wonderful fellow to work with, because after all the hard work is done, then they celebrate. They have a party, big potluck out in the field. And so Naomi tells Ruth, wait until he's done celebrating. And then she says, go in at the place that he lies down, uncover his feet, lie down, and he will tell you what you should do. Now, a lot of people get this wrong, and they say that this is a sexual relationship that's instituted here, and that's not the case. When God talks about uncovering nakedness in Scripture, he's talking about showing a vulnerability. You're not covered. Remember what Naomi asked earlier about being covered. She's telling Ruth here, Boaz will know what this means, because he's going to recognize, he knows that you're a near kinsman, if you will, that he's the near kinsman, or is a near kinsman. And he's going to know, and that's what she tells her at the end of verse 4 there. He will tell you what to do. And then notice verse 6, or verse 5, she says, all that you say to me, I will do. Did she understand? We're not told whether she did or didn't. But her willingness to continue to submit to Naomi just reinforces this aspect of integrity that we're talking about. She has shown integrity during the whole entire harvest season. She's shown that she's been willing to work hard to take care of Naomi and herself. Boaz has shown an interest in Ruth. And notice then what Boaz says in verse 7. After he'd eaten and drunk and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. So he's out in the open. This is nothing concealed. She came softly, uncovered his feet, and laid down. It happened at midnight. The man was startled, which is understandable. He turned himself, and there was a woman lying at his feet. And he says, who are you? It's dark. It's middle of the night. They don't have street lights. They don't have lights of any kind, probably, depending on the time of month. There's probably not any moonlight. He doesn't know who this person is. And so she answers, I am Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative. Naomi had instructed Ruth to remind Boaz of his obligation. Now, what obligation is that? Back in the Old Testament, the Pentateuch, God provided for the families to be preserved. And so in a case like Ruth, where she had a husband, he died before any children were born, she would have had no inheritance in the land. This is a question that came up during the wanderings. There was a family of all daughters. They didn't have husbands. And they said, well, what'll happen to us? And God says, you know, you're right. So what God provided was for the nearest male relative to provide an heir. It was not a multiple marriage, multiple wives. He was to provide an heir, and that was it. That heir was not his. It was the wife's, the former wife of the relative that died. And then that family line continued through that individual. however that played out. This is what Ruth is reminding Boaz of here. She says, it's your obligation. And notice verse 10 then. He says, blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, in that you did not go after young men, whether rich or poor. This is an indication that she was a fairly good-looking woman. Because Boaz is telling her here, you could have had your pick. The indication is that Boaz is older. We're not sure how much older. But Elimelech was married to Naomi. So if Boaz is younger, how much younger? We don't know. But he said, you could have had your pick. Notice verse 11. And now my daughter, this is another indication that he sees himself as much older. I will do for you all that you request, for all the people in my town know that you are, notice, a virtuous woman, a woman of integrity. She had a reputation beyond repute. Nobody could gainsay her. Nobody could say anything against her, denigrate her character, impugn her motives. She was a woman of virtue. And Boaz really liked that. And so he says, verse 12, now it is true that I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. There's someone older that is a nearer kinsman. So he says, stay this night, and the morning it shall be that I will perform the duty of a close relative to you. Good, let him do it if he will. But if he does not want to perform the duty for you, then I will. But stay here till morning. So she listens to him. This integrity is not just a physical attribute. It's a spiritual attribute. That's why we should consider it in our calling. That's why it's important for us to have, to be a part of God's family. This Levirate marriage is what they're talking about. This Levirate marriage that Naomi told Ruth to remind Boaz about is what's being talked about here. This near relative. He had the first right of refusal, if you will. And it's not about inheriting wealth. We'll talk about that again here in a moment. It's about continuing the family line, as I mentioned. So we move to chapter 4 in verse 1. Boaz does, as he said he would do with Ruth. He goes up to the gate of these towns, especially in the period of the judges. This is where court would be held, if you will. The elders would sit at the gate. And if somebody had a business transaction, they had a dispute, they had some matter to settle, they would come, they would present it to the elders, the elders would make a decision, there would be witnesses there, and everything would be transacted. And so Boaz goes to sit where the elders are, and he waits for his brother to come by. And as he does, he says, come sit here. And so he did. Verse 2, then he took 10 men. This is what we call a quorum. This is the witnesses to the transaction, if you will, it's taking place. So he took 10 men of the elders of the city, and he said, sit down here. And so they did. And he said to the close relative, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold a piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. And this is what God provided for in the Levirate marriage. The land was to never leave the family. They could sell it, but they either had to redeem it or wait until the Jubilee for it to come back into the family. They wanted to redeem it through the Levirate marriage, and so that's why this is taking place. So he said, she sold this land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. And I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. If you will not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am next after you. And so the brother says, I will. Now, whether he saw wealth in this, whether he saw other opportunities, but he's not thinking through the whole Levirate process. This land is redeemed. Maybe there's other outstanding debt. Maybe there were improvements added to the land that he has to compensate now for. Whatever the case is, he's not realizing that once an heir is established, this land is not his. It continues through the dead brother. Because Boaz explains in verse 5, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. And now the light goes on for the unnamed brother. In verse 6, he says, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. Now, whether that was the case or not, we're not told. But he realizes this is not an obligation he wants to fulfill. He's not willing to do it. So he says to Boaz, "You redeem my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot." And so then they go through this exchanging of shoes, which seems very odd, but it was symbolic of passing property. It was a very public proclamation. And so it is settled. But that's not the end of the story. Boaz fulfills this, but Boaz was not married. So not only does the heir become Ruth's, if you will, part of the family line, Ruth becomes his wife. So they become part of the same family line, if you will. And so then this interesting thing happens. Because of Ruth's virtuousness, notice what takes place in verse 11. All the people who were at the gate and all the elders said, "We are witnesses." Now, they're more than witnesses because look at the blessing they lay on this. This is how much they agreed with Boaz and Ruth becoming a family. "The Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, the two who built the house of Israel, and may you prosper in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez and Tamar, who bore him Judah, because of the offspring which the Eternal will give you from this young woman." Now, did they understand what they were saying? I don't think they would have had any clue what really was going to come out of this, but it ended up being very prophetic, didn't it? Because then we look next at what took place here. This is the exchange of the shoe. Not only is there an heir born, but it changes the genealogy of the family. Look at the end of the chapter. Verse 13, "Boaz took Ruth, she became his wife, she went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, she bore a son. And the women said to Naomi, 'Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a close relative, that his name may be famous in Israel.'" Go back and read the beginning of the book we didn't cover. When Naomi came home, she said, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara." Mara means bitter. She was not happy. This was not a good time in her life. And now look at what God has provided. Because of Ruth's integrity, because of Naomi's willingness to go back home and be part of that family again. Verse 15, "May he be a restorer of life to you, a nourisher in your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you." This was evident to everybody in the community how much Ruth loved Naomi, "who is better to you than seven sons." She took better care of you than your own family did. "Has borne him." And then Naomi took the child, laid him on her bosom, and became a nurse to him. The neighbor women gave him a name. I find that very curious. They named the child and said, "There is a son born to Naomi." Because see, the line goes back up and then it comes down. "And they called his name Obed." So Ruth became the great-grandmother to David. Obed is the father of Jesse, is the father of David. Now this is the genealogy of Perez. See, this is the line of Judah. So the writer goes back and reminds everybody where this came from. "Perez begot Hezron. Hezron begot Ram. Ram begot Amminadab. Amminadab begot Nahshon. And Nahshon begot Salmon. Salmon begat Boaz." Did you notice the shift there? It should have been Elimelech. Salmon begat Elimelech. He's not in the line anymore. Boaz takes his place because he redeemed Ruth. Salmon begat Boaz. Boaz begat Obed. Obed begat Jesse. Jesse begat David. And if we continue the line down through the kings of Israel, by extension, begat Jesus. Ruth became an integral part, not only of the nation of Israel, but of the very line of the Messiah. And I find it interesting, as I mentioned earlier, the middle son's not ever named. Maybe his integrity was not what God was looking for. But God grafted her into Israel. She not only had a heritage in her lifetime, look at her place in history now. There's more to the story than just her connection, though, to the lineage of Christ. In many ways, she's a forerunner of spiritual Israel because she was grafted in. She became a part of God's family. She became the fulfillment of the prophecy given in part to Abraham. Let's look at that in Genesis chapter 12. God made a promise to Abraham. Did this dawn on Ruth and Boaz, Naomi during this time? Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. We can certainly see it from the perspective of hindsight that we have, looking back in history. But in the covenant that God made with Abraham, he gave him certain promises here. And in verse 3, to break into the thought, God says to Abram, I will bless those who bless you. Ruth didn't have to go back to Judah. That was never her homeland. But she sought to bless Naomi, that integrity that she had. And she was certainly blessed because of that, wasn't she? Notice additionally, he says, I will curse him who curses you. The aspect of that middle brother never being named. He should have stepped up. If he was just looking at the cost, if you will, of the redemption, could God not have provided for that by him doing the right thing? And in the end of the verse, and in you all the families of earth shall be blessed. We certainly know that comes through Christ, but look at the physical blessings that came through Abraham as well. Look at the benefit of the modern nations of Israel and what they've provided to the world. We certainly know from Acts 10, verse 34 and 35, that God says that he's not a respecter of persons. God's not a xenophobe, as unfortunately many Jews believe today, that it is only Israel that God could have ever worked with, specifically the Jews. What does it mean then for all of us here? What does all of this come down to? God desires that all of humanity be given an opportunity to have salvation, to be a part of his eternal family in the coming kingdom. It makes no difference what background we're from. Ruth had no reason for any expectation that she'd have a good life, did she? Certainly wasn't shaping up that way initially. But look what God did through her when she submitted to his instruction, when she lived a life of integrity. God is a family, and he desires each of us to be in his family. And Ruth and her example clearly shows the importance of obedience. That's the knowledge aspect to God's way, but also in following his way. That's the doing aspect. She's an outstanding for all of us to follow in this example of integrity. Remember what that means, knowing what's right and doing what's right. Finally, let's look at one last verse. This is one of my favorite scriptures, Deuteronomy 30. Life comes down to questions of what choice we will make. It's really as simple as that. We might think it's complicated, but it's not really. And God tried to explain this to Israel as they were coming into the promised land. And it's worth, as we end today, reminding ourselves of the very same thing. Deuteronomy 30 and verse 19. God says through Moses here, I will call heaven and earth as witness against you today that I've set before you life and death. Those are the choices. Hopefully it seems odd to us, and we might ask ourselves the question, well, who would choose death? And yet, look at the culture around us. We have a culture of death around us. The violence that's magnified in our movie, our entertainment, in our music, in tattoos that people wear. It's all around us. Notice as he goes on here, he says, I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. We say, well, who would choose a cursing? And yet, look at the lives of people around us. The choices that are made and the consequences, the bad consequences that come from those choices. But God doesn't leave us wondering what to do. He says at the end of this verse here, therefore choose life. That means integrity. Choose to do the right things. Choose to live that way of life. Notice why he says that both you and your descendants may live. As we conclude today, let us remember to always choose the way of God and the integrity that he represents so that we may indeed have true life.